we wish to acknowledge the courtesy of the following sponsors for relinquishing their time today, during which we will present the special feature which follows. The makers of Post Brand, sponsors of Young Dr. Malone, the makers of Rinso and Spry, sponsors of Big Sister and Aunt Jenny's Stories, and the makers of LaFrance and Satina, sponsors of Joyce Jordan.
This is the Capitol in Washington, the House of Representatives, where the first joint session of the 77th Congress awaits the President's message on the State of the Union. Senators and representatives, and cabinet members too, are seated together here in the House to hear the President of the United States personally deliver his message as a new Congress meets in a moment of world crisis, a crisis which echoes even in this white-domed building on Capitol Hill. As the joint session waits for the appearance of the President, the scene is familiar indeed, all save the gray steel girders which reinforce the roof, the members in their chairs that form a half circle on the floor, open toward the white marble rostrum, where frock-coated Vice President John Garner presides over senators and representatives alike. Speaker of the House Sam Rayburn seated at the Vice President's left. But in many faces, and in the subdued atmosphere in this chamber also, the solemnity of this occasion can be plainly seen. Some 5 minutes ago, this joint session was called to order after a half-hour recess. Earlier, the Congress had witnessed a ceremony which is seen but once every 4 years. In polished boxes of inlaid wood, the electoral votes of the 48 states were carried to the rostrum by tellers and there read aloud. Franklin D. Roosevelt was thus officially elected for the third time as President of the United States. Vice President John Garner, gavel of his office in hand, also declared that the next Vice President of the United States will be Henry Wallace. The inauguration ceremony, January 20th, will be held on the steps of this building. And now the senators and the representatives are standing as the gavel of the Vice President fell, and the Vice President announced that the President of the United States will in a moment enter this House of Representatives chamber. Chief of the White House Secret Service, Colonel Starling, walks out on the rostrum, shakes hands with Vice President Garner, who beams back at Colonel Starling, and in a moment, the two committees will escort the President into the chamber. A moment ago, the committees were appointed, and here are their names. For the Senate, Senator Alvin W. Barkley of Kentucky, Senator Warren Austin of Vermont, Senator Pat Harrison of Mississippi. For the House of Representatives, Representative John McCormick of Massachusetts, Representative Robert Doughton of North Carolina, Representative Joseph W. Martin of Massachusetts also. And now there is almost an unearthly silence in the House of Representatives as the first members of these two committees walk slowly to the rostrum, and the senators, representatives, cabinet members catch their first glimpse of the President of the United States. He comes in slowly, his head only can be seen as we look down over the heads of the senators and representatives and the cabinet members to the rostrum. Slowly the President ascends the rostrum on the arm, I thought it was Colonel Halsey of the Senate, but his head is turned to me, and now I see that it is the President's White House naval aide. The audience applauds vociferously. There are one or two yells from the background. The packed galleries stand and applaud, and a few cheers are heard in the House of Representatives as the President of the United States, in his gray frock coat, now stands on the rostrum at the reading desk and with his right hand adjusts the microphone before he is introduced by the Vice President. The President sips a glass of water, and two or three more yells echo through the chamber. And although the reception is very warm, it is not vociferous, for there is that air of solemnity which hangs over the Capitol building as the President makes ready to deliver his message on the State of the Union. Here goes the gavel. Speaker of the House Sam Rayburn raised the gavel, started to let it fall, and when he saw that the members were about to demonstrate a bit longer, he withheld it. Now the gavel falls.
President, Mr. Speaker, members of the 77th Congress, I address you, the members of this new Congress, at a moment unprecedented in the history of the Union. I use the word unprecedented because at no previous time has American security been as seriously threatened from without as it is today. Since the permanent formation of our government under the Constitution in 1789, most of the periods of crisis in our history have related to our domestic affairs. And fortunately, only one of these, the four-year war between the states, ever threatened our national unity. Today, thank God, 130 million Americans in 48 states have forgotten points of the compass in our national unity. It is true that prior to 1914, the United States often has been disturbed by events in other continents. We had even engaged in two wars with European nations and in a number of undeclared wars in the West Indies, in the Mediterranean, and in the Pacific for the maintenance of American rights and for the principles of peaceful commerce. But in no case had a serious threat been raised against our national safety or our continued independence. What I seek to convey is the historic truth that the United States as a nation has at all times maintained opposition, clear, definite opposition to any attempt to lock us in behind an ancient Chinese wall while the procession of civilization went past. Today, thinking of our children and of their children, we oppose for enforced isolation for ourselves or for any other part of the Americas. That determination of ours, extending over all these years, was proved, for example, in the early days, during the quarter century of wars following the French Revolution. While the Napoleonic struggles did threaten interests of the United States, because of the French foothold in the West Indies and in Louisiana, and while we engaged in the War of 1812 to vindicate our right to peaceful trade, it is nevertheless clear that neither France nor Great Britain nor any other nation was aiming at domination of the whole world. And in like fashion, from 1815 to 1914, 99 years, no single war in Europe or in Asia constituted a real threat against our future or against the future of any other American nation, except in the Maximilian interlude in Mexico. No foreign power sought to establish itself in this hemisphere. And the strength of the British fleet in the Atlantic has been a friendly strength. It is still a friendly strength. Even when the World War broke out in 1914, it seemed to contain only small threat of danger to our own American future. But as time went on, as we remember, the American people began to visualize what the downfall of democratic nations might mean to our own democracy. We need not overemphasize imperfections in the Peace of Versailles. We need not harp on failure of the democracies to deal with problems of world reconstruction. We should remember that the peace of 1919 was far less unjust than the kind of pacification which began even before Munich and which is being carried on under the new order of tyranny that seeks to spread over every continent today. The American people have unalterably set their faces against that tyranny. I suppose that every realist knows that the democratic way of life is at this moment being directly assailed in every part of the world, assailed either by arms or by secret spreading of poisonous propaganda by those who seek to destroy unity and promote discord in nations that are still at peace. During 16 long months, this assault has blotted out the whole pattern of democratic life in an appalling number of independent nations, great and small. And the assailants are still on the march, threatening other nations, great and small. Therefore, as your president, performing my constitutional duty to give to the Congress information of the State of the Union, I find it unhappily necessary to report that the future and the safety of our country and of our democracy are overwhelmingly involved in events far beyond our borders.